Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Forever 35, a podcast about the things that we do to take care of ourselves. I'm Kate Spencer.
And I'm Dori Shafrir.
And Dori and I are not experts.
No, we're not. But we're two friends who like to talk a lot about serums.
We really do. And before we dig into the show, here's our rundown of things you need to know. Our website is forever35podcast.com. Anything we mention is going to be on there, good or bad. The link will be there.
Good or bad.
You can follow us on Twitter at forever35pod and on Instagram at forever35podcast. And we've got a delightful, always growing Forever 35 Facebook group where the password to get in is serums.
Serums, indeed.
That's it. Just the word serums is all you need to know. You can also hear from us via newsletter. You can sign up for that at forever35podcast.com/newsletter. And we love to hear from you. It's how we make the show. So if you'd like to reach us, you can leave us a voicemail or a text at 781-591-0390, or you can email us or send us a voice memo or send us a picture or a PDF. We don't care. We like it all. And that email address is forever35podcast@gmail.com. And in fact, we're going to be talking about an email that we received just today.
Yeah. Hot off the press.
Hot off the jeans.
So, Kate, before we get into anything, I just want to say we are going to be announcing the very exciting pre-order incentives for Thanks for Waiting.
Dori Shafrir's memoir.
Dori Shafrir's memoir, The Joy and Weirdness of Being a Late Bloomer, out from Ballantine, June 29th. These very exciting pre-order incentives are going to be announced in our newsletter tomorrow.
Oh, what a tie-in.
So, if you are not signed up for the newsletter, scurry on over to forever35podcast.com/newsletter. Sign up for a newsletter so you can get in on that. I don't want to give too much away, but all I will say is... Kate Spencer is involved.
Yes. I'm part of it.
Kate is part of it. It's going to be super fun. So yeah. So if you haven't pre-ordered my book yet, please pre-order it. And if you have pre-ordered, there will be instructions about how to get in on the pre-order incentives in the newsletter tomorrow. So sorry for the sidebar, but I just wanted to mention that.
Pre-ordering Dori's book is a fun way to spend more time with us, maybe.
Yes, it is an act of self-care.
That's right. It all comes
pre-ordering
back to
my
that,
book
Dori.
It's an act of self-care.
I mean, look, it's not a stretch.
No,
it is.
No.
Although I did want to announce, Dori, I did want to kind of make a bold announcement.
Okay.
Okay, hold on.
Everyone, this was not cleared with me ahead of time.
Nope. I didn't seek your approval on this
one. So I don't know what's coming up.
So I just took a nice, refreshing sip of water out of my 38-ounce simple modern tumbler that I've discussed, Dori, and I wanted to give you some exciting news, which is that I've been drinking water with mint leaves in it.
Ooh, yum.
And it's very refreshing.
That sounds delightful.
So I think a lot of times when people are like, I want to drink more water, but ugh, water is just so watery.
Yeah.
It just tastes so watery. Throw some mint leaves in there and give your mouth a vacation. So on today's episode, we're actually going to kick things off by discussing an email that we received. So if you are listening to this right when it comes out, this episode is airing a few days before Mother's Day. And, you know, we touched on our mixed feelings about Mother's Day on a mini episode recently after a listener wrote in about a challenging mother-in-law who likes to be celebrated. But, you know, today, later on in the episode, we're interviewing Anna Sale, who is the fantastic host of the podcast Death, Sex, and Money and the author of a wonderful new book called Let's Talk About Hard Things. And it turns out
it's so good.
It's really good.
And sorry, Kate, I just have to say, like, it was just such a joy having Anna on the podcast. Like, I think we did to her the thing that people sometimes do to us, which is like, it's so weird to see your face. I'm so used to listening to your voice.
Yeah, it was like almost strange to me that she has a human form because her voice is so like specific and soothing and like it felt very surreal to discover that she is a person.
Yes. And speaking of buying books as acts of self-care, her book really is an act of self-care. So I recommend it. Anyway, sorry, Kate. I keep distracting us.
It's okay, Tori. That's what I'm here for.
So great.
We got this email and it addressed a hard thing. And I thought maybe it might be a good time to kind of dig deeper into this. So let me read it and then I think we'll go from there. A listener wrote us today, actually. Hi, pals. Thank you so much for focusing this week's activity on self-care planning for Mother's Day. This was in reference to our mini episode. I have been dreading Mother's Day this year. My mom is dying of early onset Alzheimer's, and I miss her so much, even though she's still here. And I had a miscarriage 2 months ago that I've had a really hard time coping with. I'm also a nurse and totally burnt out from the last year, so I have no ideas on how to take care of myself on Mother's Day. What are you or other listeners doing for Mother's Day self-care? I would love some ideas. So I think it's first good just to acknowledge that while Mother's Day and then Father's Day, which is also looming right around the bend, can be wonderful days of celebration, they also are extraordinarily painful for a lot of people. And I don't really know. Until I lost my own mom, I don't think I realized how hard it would be to get through Mother's Day and how many people were struggling for a variety of reasons. And Dori, I know that you've had this experience as someone living with infertility and having Mother's Day roll around.
Yeah, there were a couple, and a similar thing, Kate, in that, you know, I had never fully wrapped my head around how hard Mother's Day is for a lot of people. Of course, because, you know, I'm a selfish person. So until it happened to me, I was like, but anyway, there were a couple Mother's Days in there. I would say the two prior to getting pregnant with Henry were very hard for me. And yeah, so I don't know. I see you, people for whom this day is tough.
Yeah, so do I. And I'm wondering, Dori, when you went into those days, did you do anything or did you schedule anything on Mother's Day specifically to kind of care for yourself during that day, knowing it would be hard?
That is a really good question. I'm actually just looking at my calendar from Mother's Day 2018.
What did you do?
It looks like I went to restorative yoga.
Oh, see?
Yep.
That's so nice.
Yep. And let's see, what was I doing in 2017? I had a busy Sunday in 2017.
What did you do on Mother's Day 4 years ago?
We had brunch with another couple who also who don't have children. I did a podcast interview because it was right after my book had come out. And I went to restorative yoga.
Oh, look at this theme that's emerging for you.
Yeah.
So, well, there's Dory's suggestion.
Yeah.
A gentle physical practice.
Yeah. I mean, in all seriousness, I think that was very important and grounding for me at that time.
I had one Mother's Day. I think it was the second one after my mom died, where I went to yoga because yoga was very like therapeutic and healing for me always, but especially during those first few years after my mom died. And I didn't know this, but the yoga class was a like, bring your mom, you get to come for free. So there were just like,
oh my God,
mothers and daughters.
Oh my God.
Packing into this class. And I was like, oh fuck me. It's just like at every turn, a trigger of my grief.
That is like out of a movie.
Now I can look back and laugh, but it has been a very long time.
Must have been so upsetting for you.
It was very hard. So the first Mother's Day after my mom had passed away, I very actively planned what I was going to do. Like I ran a road race in Central Park. I had brunch scheduled with a small group of friends, including my husband. I've done stuff like that where I have really tried to schedule the day out and make sure it's about me nurturing myself.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before I became a mom myself. It has changed since becoming a mother.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most important thing is to take care of yourself in whatever way that means. Like that might just mean being sad on the couch and watching Call My Agent, which is very good.
My sister started watching it.
Dory is right about this, everybody. I just feel like I'm going to constantly be mentioning how right Dory was. But I think specifically to what this listener is presenting in having experienced miscarriage and loss in that way, being a nurse during COVID, and then that... I've never had a parent or a person close to me with Alzheimer's, but I did. There was a short time when my mom was dying where she was in this like in between phase where she was not herself anymore, but she was still alive and it was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can kind of sympathize with what this listener is speaking about. And that is just must be a devastating way to experience your relationship with your parent to have to go through that. So
yeah,
I would say like, if there is something that's going to make you feel good, whether it's reflecting on your relationship with your mom or not, focus on just getting through.
Yeah.
And if you know, for some people that might mean like going to work that day. For other people, it might mean getting a massage.
Right.
But it's really hard. And I think another important thing that people can do is kindly acknowledge to others that it might be hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
I always appreciate when people note that. And it's like hard for fucking everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So, you know, if people have other suggestions of like concrete rituals or things you could do, kind of note the day, I would love to hear them. I'm really curious. And same with Father's Day, same with other sorts of like anniversaries or celebrations that actually end up being very emotionally challenging.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff like this.
Yeah.
And I mean, God, Dory, the freaking emails. This year is worse than any other year.
The like promotional emails.
Yeah. And I, you know, to be honest, I have even been really sensitive about it when reading advertisements that we're recording, because some of the ad copy we've received has specifically asked us to focus it on Mother's Day. And whenever that happens, I always, and same with Father's Day, I always try to modify the language a little bit to make it more inclusive, because it's really hard having to sit through a podcast and then have be like, hey, everybody,
totally
for your mom this year, you know, like totally. Now I'm part of the machine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, it's a hard thing, but luckily we have an expert on hard things coming to talk to us today.
We do. So as we were saying a little bit ago, our guest today is Anna Sale of the Death, Sex, and Money podcast and the author of the new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. And I just love talking to her so much. So
yeah, we talk about hard things with her. Sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
No, I was just going to say we're going to take, I don't want to delay getting to her any longer.
No,
so
let's get to her.
We're going
to
take a short break and we will be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I like to care for my skin, duh. And it's also something that I do love to kind of like get into the research on.
You do have a curious mind.
Look, I have a curious mind. I can't help it.
You do.
But today's sponsor, OneSkin, has made that easy because they do their own fantastic research for their products. In fact, their products are scientifically validated to improve your skin's health while targeting the root cause of aging. The secret is OneSkin's proprietary OS1 peptide. It's the first ingredient proven to switch off the aging cells that cause lines, wrinkles, and thinning skin, and they've got several studies to back it up. They also have an amazing new sunscreen.
Ooh, our favorite.
Our fave. It's the OS1 Shield Protect and Repair SPF 30 Plus. It's got the peptide. It's a mineral sunscreen. It's got antioxidants. It comes in tinted and untinted. I mean, like, what can't this thing do? I'm just saying. I love it. It's so easy to use. And I love that it's just like, zoop, and it feels so nice going on. But don't take my word for it. OneSkin has over 4,000 five-star reviews and was recently recognized by Fast Company as one of the most innovative brands of 2024. OneSkin is the world's first skin longevity company. By focusing on the cellular aspects of aging, OneSkin keeps your skin looking and acting younger for longer. Get started today with 15% off using code FOREVER at oneskin.co. That's 15% off oneskin.co with code FOREVER. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them, and please support your show and tell them we sent you.
Y'all, I was in head to toe quince the other day, and I have never felt better. This is not an exaggeration. I loved my entire outfit, and it was literally everything was from Quince.
Wow. I was okay. Did you deliberately go head to toe Quince, or just was like, oh, I want to wear this. I want to wear this. And then you were like, oh, I'm in head to toe Quince.
All right. Let me tell you what happened. Okay. So I knew I wanted to put on, I have these pants from Quince that I'm obsessed with. They're called the French Terry Modal wide leg pant. They're so comfortable and they look really stylish. So they like feel like you're wearing a comfy sweat, but they're like a gorgeous flowy pant. And my child complimented them. It was wild.
Wow.
And then I was like, you know what? It's warm out, but it's also kind of chilly. What could I wear? And I have a zip up cashmere hoodie from Quince. And I was like, well, I'll put this on. And then I was like, LOL, I'm in all Quince. I might as well just put on this Quince white t-shirt that I have, because I wanted a white t-shirt. Like, it just, so the t-shirt, I was like, you know, I was kind of like, tee-hee, only I know I'm in head to toe Quince. But I share this to share, like, one, how much I just love their pieces and how much use I get out of them, because I like to be comfortable, but I also want to look like slightly put together. And I just feel like either individually or on their own, all my items from Quince just They just work. They just work.
Okay. I love that for you.
They travel beautifully. I have a really beautiful linen dress from Quince that travels really well. They have washable silk tops, 14 karat jewelry. And the best part, you know, with Quince is that all items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner directly with top factories, which means Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman. And they pass those savings on to us. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Quince.
They also only work with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I really love that. I love my products from Quince. And you know what? Dare I say, I looked good. So whether you want to be cozy or get warm weather ready, do it with Quince. Go to quince.com/forever35 for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/forever35 to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/forever35.
Our guest today is the one and only Anna Sale. Anna, welcome to Forever 35.
Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. If you do not know Anna or you don't recognize her voice, she is the creator and host of Death, Sex, and Money, the podcast from WNYC Studios about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. And before launching Death, Sex, and Money, Anna covered politics for nearly a decade. She has contributed to Fresh Air with Terry Gross and This American Life and is the author of the new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things. She grew up in West Virginia and now lives in Berkeley, California with her husband and two daughters. And we were just chatting before we started recording, just telling Anna what big fans we are of Death, Sex, and Money and how exciting it is to have you here on the show. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Let's start the same way we start with the vast majority of our guests. We would love to hear about a self-care ritual that you have.
This is so basic. It's like embarrassing, but it feels like a revelation to me. I work East Coast hours, so I wake up before the rest of my family and hop on a call at 7 a.m. Pacific time because the rest of my team's in New York. And somehow, more than a year into all working from home, I just realized that I should take a walk while I do that morning call, which is like just so basic. Mm-hmm. But I have found, you know, I just, my time working is so, can be so focused and intense because I know I have a really hard cutoff when there's preschool pickup. So just to get outside and walk the dog while we're doing that conference call and just kind of talking about the plan for the day as a team, it's just been, it just helps me feel more human. But it feels like a pathetic self-care thing because I'm still working. I'm not really doing anything. That's not that. I'm not sure how much that counts, but it is. It is a small thing that I'm noticing has a marked improvement in how I feel.
Well, we have to squeeze it in where we can, right? I mean, I feel like it's all about. It can't be all or nothing.
Yeah.
So it seems reasonable that you would do it while you work. I think that's actually very wise.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question about it? Do you tell your team, or was there ever any point where you felt guilty or like you weren't going to be focusing? I feel like a lot of those thoughts tend to run through my head personally whenever I do any kind of ounce of self-care while also working.
Yeah, it's so like I found the first time that someone was like, "Oh, it's in Slack." And I was like, "Oh, I'm walking. I'm not looking at my computer while I'm on the call." Or I'm not looking at my calendar while I'm on the call. It felt a little bit like, am I doing work the right way? Did I just get caught cheating? But it's really not that big a deal. Like, it's funny that I felt weird about it and like I was doing a wrong thing. But actually, when you're walking and talking, I think you are more open and can be less rigid. I can be less rigid. I can be more like, oh, you know, than when you're in that mode of like, what is the immediate to do thing? Because we're talking about something, I'm going to start typing while we're talking. I think it actually makes me a better worker.
I also love that it's a phone call and not a Zoom.
Oh, yeah. Bring back the call. Love the phone call. Yeah.
Bring back the call. Yeah. Yeah. Enough with all these Zooms. My goodness. Anna, on your show, as you say, these are things that we think about a lot and need to talk about more. And they're often very emotionally raw topics. And so I'm wondering, what does self-care look like for you when you are kind of getting people to open up so much and having to sort of live through vicariously some of this trauma yourself? How does that feel?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I usually feel at the end of a hard interview, say if it's someone who has like, it's clear that they're still very much in the raw feelings of pain. You know, those are the ones that take a lot out of me, where you just like, especially in the last year when you're working from home and you just like close the recording session and all of a sudden it's you and your back bedroom, like going like, oh, I just hope this person, I want to know what this person is doing next. I want to know if they have a friend who they're going to be able to talk to. I want to know if someone's going to feed them a nice meal. So that's sort of where I go. And I think the thing that I really like about working from home is my kids are almost 5 and almost 2.5. So they don't care what I have gone through while I've been working. They're just like, I want a snack. I want to walk around the neighborhood. No, I want to turn left. I don't want to turn right. I want to like that, you know, I want to go to this playground, not that playground. And just getting to like be, it's just so in the moment with them. And I actually find, you know, I'm not like laying down with cucumber slices on my eyes as a way of relaxing, but it gets me out of my head in a way that is really nice because also I'm doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing when I'm not doing anything else but playing with them. You know, like there's nothing else I'm supposed to be doing when I'm in our afternoon time. Like, it gets a little hairier when it gets to like dinner time and making dinner and that kind of thing. But for that, like 90 minutes of like, you know, 3:30 to 5, we just get to be together.
Yeah. Yeah. On a recent episode, the episode that actually came out today, you said that being a parent has changed the way you interview.
Mm-hmm.
How has it changed the way you interview?
Well, I didn't really expect this, but I think so much of like, when I'm talking to one person, I think more about the family unit that they might come from and how whatever they have been through has been an experience that perhaps other people in their family are experiencing. Like, I often think when someone is talking to me about something hard or challenging, I think like, do their parents know? How do their parents show up, not show up? Like, how heartbreaking must this be for their parents to not be able to protect them from this? So I think it's made me have a little bit more awareness of like the multiple dimensions of perspective on one story, you know, because I'm immediately thinking like, oh, how does their child think about this? How does their parent think about this? You know, and not just being, you know, solely focusing on this one person's version of the narrative.
Can we talk a little bit about coming up with the idea for Death, Sex, and Money?
Yeah.
Why did you want to create this show? Which I will say, Dory and I both love, but when those three words are like, three of my biggest scary words. What was it about these three topics in particular that really resonated with you to the point that you felt called to talk about it in this way?
Yeah. I mean, what I remember about coming up with the name of the show was I was like walking around, I was walking the dog, And I was thinking, you know, I'd been covering politics for a long time. And the thing that I most liked about covering politics was that thing that you could do where you could be like, the politician is saying this, but here's really what's happening. You know, there's this version of like, I'm helping middle class families and da 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 da. And like, actually, here's what's happening. Here's the impact of the policies that they're supporting. And here's who's funding their campaigns, et cetera, et cetera. And so I sort of was like, all these personal interviews that I hear, like, I want to know more about the actual stuff that like is really going on. Like, why doesn't anybody ever talk about how they covered their rent when they were figuring out like how to be this best-selling novelist? Like, where'd that money come from? You know? And, cause that's a really interesting story. It was something I was thinking about a lot, in my early 30s in New York City. How did people do this? And then I thought, you know, and I remember thinking about eulogies and the things that people, you know, if you were going to sum up someone's life in a 15-minute talk, you're going to talk about who they loved and who loved them. You're going to talk about the work they did in the world and what its impact was. You're going to refer to some of the hard moments and the rough patches, and then the fact is that it's over. And so I was like, why do we at the end of life say like, these are the most important touchstones, but there's just not enough journalistic inquiry into what's happening as it's unfolding? And so that was sort of the idea. And then when I thought like, what are the three, like how would it be named? And I thought death, sex, and money. And then I realized that was DSM. And I thought that was like funny that it was like the DSM-4, the DSM-5, like the manual of psychiatric conditions. I thought that was kind of funny. And also like, kind of like laughed at the boldness of it. Like, what if you just said this is a show about death, sex, and money? Like, what happens then? So it was kind of like,
yeah,
let's roll our sleeves up and do this. And also a little bit like, you know, I think it has a little edge of humor because it's not just like, it could have been called the most important things or something, which is just like a little too earnest. I wanted a little like edge, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. You succeeded. Like even just saying it now, I'm like, ooh.
I mean, the most hilarious thing is sometimes like my 4-year old says it out. She's like, death, sex, and money. And I'm like, oh, that's a little strange. You know? Coming out of a small person's mouth.
Well, luckily you wrote a whole book about these topics.
Yeah.
Well, it has your like comfort level in dealing with them increased because you throughout your book, you also are talking about your own life.
Yeah. I mean, I think what I have gotten more comfortable with is, and what I kind of discovered while I was writing, I was like, what do I want to say here? Like, what is something that's important to keep in mind if you're having a hard conversation about money or a hard conversation about family or identity? Like, what do I want to say? And I found that like, oh, if I start each of these big chapters, death, sex, money, family, and identity with like, here's what is hard about this topic, and you're going to have this impulse to make this part of it not hard, but you can't. Like death is death. It is not a loss you can fix. It is not an end you can get around. It is there. And so if you kind of look at that and then say like, oh, my friend who just lost her mother suddenly, like what is the thing that I can say? I don't have the responsibility of making it not hard in the ways that I want to comfort her. Instead, I can say something like, I can just, I love you. I'm so sorry. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to call you every few weeks and just check in. You don't have to answer, but like, you know, some way of like going in with someone around the hard thing and being alongside them instead of saying something, which I understand why, because you want to make people feel better. You might end up saying like, she's not suffering anymore. or, you know, at least she lived a long life. You know, that's not what you want to hear when all of a sudden your mom who was here is not here anymore. You have a lot of, you know, you've got a lot of feelings to move through. And so, to figure out how to be that friend who is the one who's like, oh, are you really angry? You know, who you're angry today. Tell me about that. You're mad today. You're depressed today. Like, you're actually feeling better today. Like, let's be together in this. You know, another example is money. Like, one of the things we can't talk about money because we don't like to say out loud that people have different amounts. You know, something that basic, like, we want to pretend in our personal relationships that, like, you know, we somehow all, you know, have this idea, you know, if you write down your dreams and make vision boards and, you know, use your resources wisely, your dreams can come true. That's actually not true. Like, people move through life with different access to different resources. And instead, like, what would it be like if when you're talking to a friend or a coworker who's like trying to figure out, how do I start my podcast? Like to say, I try to say things like, well, here's what was going on with me. Like, I never had to quit my job at WNYC. So I didn't have to, like, I got to move from covering politics to making this show. So that meant I didn't have to go through those feelings of like, how am I going to pay my rent 3 months in? Like, but, you know, if you do it the other way, you're going to build something you own, like you all do. And there's a lot of benefit to that as well. So, like, let's talk about trade-offs and things like that.
Right.
So I guess what doing the show and making the book has made me just more comfortable with is, like, here's all the things I don't have to try to do in a hard conversation. I don't have to, like, make these things not hard, but I can show up and be, I think I've gotten more comfortable in that space of not being able to have the thing to say that's going to make it better or fix it. Like, and instead just like, let's describe what's going on right now, you know?
I really appreciated your whole chapter on death. Mm-hmm. And I thought one thing that was really interesting that you talked about that isn't always talked about, is the way that we are really not conditioned to talk to people about death. We're only, like, the language we use is often about the disease or finding a cure. And often the conversation about, you know, finding a cure or fighting it is happening as the person is dying, right? But the way we have been kind of taught to approach it is not to really even acknowledge the existence of death or looming death. And I would love to know your thoughts after kind of, you know, especially with a lot of the people that you interviewed, talking to them, how do you think we can, as individuals, kind of open up our own understanding around death and dying? Especially because oftentimes the way we're experiencing it is through social media or through media and not as often as, you know, in our own lives, especially right now in COVID.
Yeah.
This is like 50 questions in one. Kind of, sorry, but
that's okay.
I thought you handled it really well.
Thank you. I mean, what that question made me think about was, it's like a study of the psychological well-being of caregivers who took care of, people at end of life, people they loved at end of life. And something that was, I thought was really interesting was they separated out the experience of managing the logistics of the care with, like, did you have conversations and talk about the emotional impact of the end of life and death, and how when you do the one thing, even when you're really close up to someone declining and approaching death and you're doing all of them a very intimate physical care and seeing it, if there's not a parallel conversation about, you know, what are you afraid of right now? Do you want to talk? Like, just like having a conversation between the two of you, then grief is a lot more complicated. Complicated grief is like a term that therapists use. Complicated grief is, just all grief, I think, is complicated, but that's an actual term that they use to describe sort of just like kind of grief that you can get stuck in and can be more sort of critical in a critical stage for a longer period of time. So I guess what I would say is, you know, I don't have a really straightforward answer, but I do think it's okay to like try to sort of open the topic with someone you love, say who's like, even if they're not dying, if they're just getting old, like it can be so scary to say, like, you know, you're noticing the ways someone you love is slowing down a little bit, or, you know, walking a little bit more with tender steps, and you notice all that stuff, but it can feel like you're being rude if you admit it, like you're somehow, insulting them, or it could hurt their dignity. While I was working on the book, I sort of challenged myself to talk to a really dear friend of mine who's now 89. She was in her mid 80s when we talked in the book. Just to say, like, what's this like for you? You know? And to hear she'd been sick and then she'd recovered, and she had a lot to say about what she had, you know, thought about, because she'd sort of had an experience of illness, of getting sick enough that she realized, oh my God, I am going to die, you know, which to me in my 30s interviewing her, a woman in her mid 80s, I, you know, you sort of have this idea, like, by that time, surely you're more comfortable with the idea of death. Like, but no, yeah. It's still a surprise. So I think it's about like having sort of conversations where you acknowledge, like, you know, aging or illness, and sort of see where the person is that you want to talk, that you want to have a kind of deeper conversation. You know, you can't force it, because if someone doesn't want to go there with you, it can be, you know. You'll see where they don't want to talk about it. You know, even someone who's maybe has a terminal diagnosis, if they have not integrated that idea, moving out of the sort of, we're going to fight this together can be hard. But, I think it's just about kind of trying to sort of have the kind of open question, just like, wow, what was it like when, maybe it's asking, you know, what was it like when this person, when you said goodbye to this person, you know, maybe have like sort of parallel conversations about their experiences with death and see where that goes, and just sort of feel around. And then if you hear a, like a prompt that like they say something about their own death, like don't flinch from that, like talk about it, even though it's probably going to be scary for you. A doctor talked to me about that for the book, about, you know, he's a primary care physician and he tries to get his older patients to really sort of think about end of life planning. And it's a delicate opening. The opening is really hard. You're reading what someone is ready to talk about. But he says, you know, as soon as they say the word death, I'm like, I go in, you know, and then I say, well, let's talk about that. Like, what do you picture for yourself? You know, like just when you get a little sense that that door is cracked open, you know, that's an opportunity.
Well, and also, as you point out, not everyone has a period where they are sick.
Yeah.
Some people die suddenly and unexpectedly. And if you haven't had those conversations at all, that can be especially difficult, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you haven't had the experience in the last year of having someone in your social circle who was healthy and then was sick and died, I'm really happy for you. But a lot of people have had that experience. And I think it's shattering. It's hard. And I think your question about social media, like how to express care with social media, like what I have experienced death. That's the way I've experienced death most in my life up to this point, is like all of a sudden you see the Facebook post that, you know, your friend from high school died suddenly, or all of a sudden you see the Facebook post that a friend of yours lost their parent. You know, and I have this sort of like line that I say in a post, like, oh, you're in my heart, or I love, you know, da 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 da. So, some like sort of, I try to like walk the line of respecting whatever their religious beliefs are with my religious beliefs, you know, that kind of weird line. But I've sort of challenged myself to like, do that follow-up call, you know, do that a week later, just say, hey, I'm thinking about you, you know? And it can be really, it's important.
Yeah. One thing that I also appreciated that you wrote about in that chapter was kind of destigmatizing the idea that we are like, we're curious why people died.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I always feel a little guilty, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot going on when we all, when we're like, wait, what happened? How did that person die? Because I want to make sure I'm not going to die. You know, yeah. Like Freud wrote about that, you know, like, So I think that there is a sort of like, kind of like shamey way that we feel about that. But I do think this is something Alicia Garza talked about. It's just the importance of naming how someone, why someone is gone, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes that's to say, you know, she talks about the importance for her of saying like, this person was murdered by a police officer. I'm not going to like, that's the language that she uses. She's, if you're not familiar, the activist who coined the term Black Lives Matter. And she also talks about, you know, like being in Oakland and how people, she uses the term that people in her neighborhood and her community like die of neglect. People of her community die, you know, of gun violence. Like, just the ways in which you think about naming what happened, is important, you know. And then I also think, oh man, like there have been a lot of people in my life who have had an experience of losing someone because of drug addiction, I just think, you know, when you see someone figure out the words to say like, this is how we lost this person and this was their struggle and this was what happened, and figuring out how to both honor and express love for who the person was and what the struggle was for them. It's just how powerful that can be, like for people who are either in addiction themselves or who love someone in addiction, like to see, you know, that's I think been a big part of advancing the conversation about how we think about drug addiction and as an illness as opposed to a moral failing, like to figure out how to be more open about what happened.
Yeah, I loved the conversation with Alicia Garza and how she talked about kind of using ritual to really acknowledge and honor, and how language was a part of that. And then also talking to her about how losing her friend and how there was a lot of guilt in that experience, and how she kind of, I wouldn't say resolved it because it's not a resolution, but kind of figured out a way to acknowledge the grief she was feeling. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, she had the experience, you know, she's a young woman, a friend of hers from college. She like got a text from like, I'm in town, can I come see you? And they didn't connect. And then Alicia found out a day or so later that her friend Joy De La Cruz, who was a poet, had died in a car accident. And Alicia had both the sort of shock of that experience of like, oh, I didn't see her, you know, like we didn't connect. And then also she became the sort of middle hub of the wheel to tell all of their friends. So she had to sort of be the person who was telling everyone. And what ended up happening, which was really hard, really, really hard. And what ended up happening is all of these friends of hers from college who knew Joy sort of gathered together to have a memorial service. And then they all just kind of kept hanging out for like a week. And then it became this thing that they did year after year. This was the way that they connected. And of course, it didn't make the loss of Joy less sad or, you know, the pain less acute, but it became something that they could sort of gather around and be with each other in. I loved that story.
So we're just going to take a short break and we will be right back. Okay, we're back. I wanted to shift gears a little bit to the sex chapter.
Let's do it.
I'm already nervous.
One thing that you wrote in the chapter was learning to accept rejection is equally as important as learning how to give and ask for permission. What is so hard about rejection? How can we learn to accept it?
I mean, it's hard. Like, it's hard because it's someone saying, I don't want you. You know, that's the hardest. That's the hardest. Yeah. Or that can be the way it feels. Of course, a lot of times it's like, I got a lot going on and, you know, you really don't want me if you knew. You know, but, you know, I try to.
Yes,
that's fair. Yeah.
the way I think about why sex conversations are so hard is because that is the thing. Like, you are trying to figure out, what do I want to do with this person? Like, you know, both sort of from a physical standpoint and also like, what kind of vision do I have for what our companionship might look like? Is it monogamous? Is it long term? Is it, you know, are we going to have babies together? Like, what do I want? And then running right alongside that, this other person is like, taking a look at you and saying like, what do I want? What do I want with this person? And, you know, and the only way you can figure out if those match up, is by putting words to it, you know, because like, I think even when you're first getting together, even if it's hot and steamy and like, you can tell everybody's into it, I think it's important to also just like, have those words to be like, can I do this? Can I do this in that sexy way? And just affirmative consent. And so if you recognize that that's what's happening, and like, the hard thing about a sex conversation is like, you might not end up wanting the same thing. Like, that's what rejection is. It's when you wanted something with this person that they don't want. And you sometimes just desperately wish they would, you know, something would change the sort of like, they would go from black and white to color, like it would just switch and they would see what you see, but you can't. Every relationship we have that's not with a partner who we, you know, die with or who dies on us, like every other relationship ends with somebody saying, I want something different than this, or I don't want this. Like, and when you refuse to hear it, there can be really like damaging consequences, you know?
Well, and I might be getting this slightly jumbled, but I think later in the chapter, you also talk about how it's like not the person who rejected us's responsibility to make us feel better.
Yeah.
About the rejection.
Yeah. I mean, we can ask them. We can be like, you know, you can say like, I just really need to understand what happened, you know, and maybe they can say something, but really that's not going to be the person, you know, who's like, do you really want to hear someone saying like, actually, I looked at you and realized I didn't want to be with you. Like, you don't, that's not going to make you feel better, know, or like, even like, so it's kind of like, but we think because they did it, that they can undo it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in your book, you write about how your first marriage ended in part because you say you never really got it, like the values behind the way that you and your ex-husband thought about money. Can you just talk about kind of what that means and how can people have these conversations that get to the root of why they feel the way they do about money?
This is really hard because I think the thing that I like that is really useful to me to think about is like, money, we have one word for something that means all of the beliefs I have about stability and survival and interdependence and independence. That's one thing money means. And then the other thing money means is like, what are we going to do with these numbers? And are we going to put this here? And are we going to do this? Are we going to save this? You know, the personal finance sort of angle. And I like love, like for me, I'm like a, I just love a spreadsheet when it comes to money. I like that feeling of control. And so I like can really do the like, should we save this in this account? And like, are you doing this for your retirement? And what about this? And should we save this for this? But if you're not talking about like where that fits into sort of the vision together, you're missing a lot. And then it can surprise you when it, when like a huge fundamental misalignment comes up. And so I think, you know, I write in the book because I was like, huh, did I get divorced because of money? Like, that seems so boring. And also just like, really? Couldn't you just like figure it out? You know? But I think another way is like, yes, we got divorced because of money, because we wanted our lives to look really different. And that had huge consequences for how we thought about what kind of choices we needed to make when it came to, you know, financial stability or, you know, where we were investing and where we were taking risks and that sort of thing. Like my story was I got married at 26 and my first husband, when we met and when we got married, he was a civil rights lawyer. And a few years into our marriage, he was like this creative person always, but he decided he wanted to go to film school in the middle of the recession, which was very hard for me. It was very scary. It was very, very scary. And it like all of the consequences of that, like he wanted to sort of like be wide open to the world and be open to projects all over and be a filmmaker. And I wanted what I thought we had decided we were going to have together, which was like, we're building a life, we're doing our jobs, and we're going to have a house and we're going to have kids. And it was like, when we finally had the argument where he said we were on a small plane and he said it loudly and other people could hear, and it was horrifying and mortifying and sad. He was just like, I don't want what you want. You know, he just like said it. And it was like, oh, okay, like now that's on the table. Like, what does that mean? Like, can I want what you want? You know, we went to couples counseling, we did all the thing, read the books. And slowly, once we were like scratching at the actual thing we were fighting over, we got to the place where it was like, we have had a great relationship and a great love and a lot of great times together. And it doesn't make sense for us to be married to each other forever. We want different things.
And you got remarried and you have two daughters and you spent a chunk of the pandemic at your in-laws house in Wyoming, recording Sex and Money from a Closet.
Yes. Yeah.
So what was that experience?
Their closet, my in-laws' bedroom closet, because it was the biggest.
So, what was that experience like? And did you have to have any hard conversations while you were there?
You know, it was by and large, especially since you know, I haven't been with them now since the fall. We were there for like the start of the pandemic through the summer, and since it's been several months, like now, I think back on is like, what was so special and precious about that time together, you know, because we won't ever have that again, that extended period of living in as far as I know, I don't have any expectation it will happen, but an extended period of like living as a multi-generational family. And, they were wonderful. They like showed up and they were our childcare for the first few months of, when all of that fell away. So they were wonderful. What was hard was like, it's hard to be a parent while you're being watched. You know, that was the thing that was the hardest for me. And I think for Arthur is like, you know, when you're like because you end up sort of in this weird space of like being a little bit protective of your own choices and style. And then if it's not working and the child is acting out, you're both sort of like so annoyed at the kid, but also like protective of the kid because you don't want the grandparents to be judging the kid. You know, like it's so complicated. So that was like the thing that was.
Yes. This is resonating.
You know, and like, so that was like the hardest thing because it just makes you, you know, and it's, I get it. It's hard because like the grandparents are grandparents. So like they want to, you know, they want to like be tender with the kids and they also don't want the kids to be a-holes, you know? So when they're jerks, like you're like, oh, come on. Like don't be a jerk at the dinner table when we're all together. Like eat your food. Like as we've talked about, sit in your seat and eat your food. And then when you try like, one intervention, like here's the timer, eat your food, and the timer doesn't work. You know, it just becomes this thing of like, oh, I'm just being watched while the things I'm trying as a parent aren't working. And that makes me feel a little bit sensitive, you know. But that was like really, that was the hardest part for us because a lot of the other stuff that could have been really hard, they just were incredible and just, and helpful. Mm. Like figuring out how to be helpful. And I find like, wow, when you have in-laws who like can see the little spaces where they can like fold the laundry that's in that hamper just cause without in a way that like makes you feel overly parented, but the all of a sudden the laundry is folded. It's like, oh my God. Thank you, Jesus. Yes. You know? Yes. It's like, it's the best.
Well, Anna, I feel like we could talk to you for another few hours, but we should probably let you go. But this has really been such a treat to get to talk to you. And can you tell our listeners where they can find you and find your book that just came out and listen to your podcast?
Yeah. So you can find the show at deathsexmoney.org. And there, if you're not already subscribed, you can connect to whatever podcast player you use and subscribe. And we also have like all the archives going back to 2014 and a starter kit if you want to just like go into the episodes we love the best. And my book is called Let's Talk About Hard Things. And you can get it wherever you buy books. And if you go to, I think it's the link on my Twitter page, it's the bookshop.org link. Is if you don't know where you want to buy it from the link on my Twitter, which is at Anna Sale, and it goes to support Taylor Books in Charleston, West Virginia, which is the bookstore where I had my first job. So we should all buy our copies of the book from them.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you, Anna. Again, this was such a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was a dream.
I think this is such a necessary book.
I agree.
It's really great. And also, you know, a lot of us grew up in homes or communities where, like, we didn't talk about hard things.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's still hard to talk about hard things.
Yeah, I mean, not no
by definition. That's why they're hard. You know,
it is. It is. But like, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking of different scenarios for people I know where, like, let's say somebody died and then they were never talked about again because it was too painful to discuss. You know?
Yeah, and you know, I think it's also always a good reminder for me to not like tiptoe around death in particular when I know someone who is close to someone who died. You know?
Interesting. Do you feel like you're a tiptoeer about death?
I feel like I don't always know how to bring it up. Yeah, but now I feel like I have I'm armed with like better scripts. So
yeah, I feel that way about
money?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still don't know how to, that's still such a learning process for me.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are feeling any of these things, we cannot recommend this book enough. Yeah. She's just the coolest.
Well, let's move on to the intention zone.
Yeah, because you've got some food to tell me about. Quickles? What are quickles?
Quick pickles.
Okay. Set the scene. Dory's intention last week was to cook a recipe from past guest Julia Tertian's new cookbook.
Yeah, so I had already cooked something. I'd made the fish cakes, which were a hit. Okay. And my intention was to just cook something else from her cookbook. So I made the sesame rice bowls with tofu, quickles, and peanut sauce. And they were easy, definitely easy to make. I thought they were pretty good. I don't know if I will make this again, to be perfectly honest. Okay. I will probably make the fish cakes again.
Okay.
Which surprised, like, if you had asked me between the two of these which one I would like better, I would have said the sesame rice bowls. But in fact, I think I like the fish cakes better. So there we go.
Live and learn.
Live and learn. So this week, my intention is I think we're going to take a weekend getaway.
Now, by we, do you mean yourself, your husband, and your child? Or was this just a couple's retreat?
Not just me and my husband. I think the three of us are going to go away. So, you know, it's not going to be like super relaxing, but I really just need like a change of scenery, which I have not had in a very long time. So, my intention is to plan that this week.
That sounds fun.
Can
I come?
Sure. Do you want to be Henry's babysitter all weekend?
Would it be weird if I was also there?
I mean,
I'd babysit him. That would be fun. Henry and I could go for walks and you guys could, you know, sleep.
Yeah, great.
Well, I hope you figure that out, because I do think you guys could use a break sounds lovely.
Thank you so much.
It is deserved.
Thank you. How did planning your summer go?
Good. So I am embarking on a cross-country journey with my children this summer, where we are going to do some resting and spending time with family members we haven't seen in a very long time. And I'm really looking forward to it. But there's a lot of logistical stuff. So I am feeling on top of it, which is good. And this week, I'm like nervous about this intention, but I'm going to start trying to meal plan again. If you've been around these woods long enough, these Forever 35 woods, you've heard me mention that I like meal planning, but that went out the window like 5 months ago. And I have been heavily relying on like HelloFresh to feed me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of at the point where I think I'm ready to revisit what it means to like plan out our meals and cook. And I don't know, like, I will say, like, HelloFresh has been great, and my kids really like a lot of the meals, which has been amazing. In fact, like, I've had to go and replicate one of the meals that my daughter liked so much and figure out how to make it myself. So kudos to you, HF. But I think I'm ready to, like, figure this out on my own, or at least try.
Yeah.
You know, at least try. I went to a grocery store the other day. That felt great. So I don't know. Will this be a disaster? Will we all end up just eating chicken nuggets every night? Remains to be seen. We had pizza last night. You know, whatever it takes.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited for you. And
you know what? I might actually, I think I'm going to make those fish cakes.
Oh, they're super easy.
Yeah, I think I might do that. So stay tuned. I'll report back.
I can't wait to hear.
All right. Well, listen, everybody, thank you so much for listening. We appreciate you. We hope you have a lovely day. And Forever 35 is hosted and produced by Dory Shafrir and Kate Spencer, and produced and edited by Sammy Junio. Sam Reed is our project manager, and our network partner is Acast. And we will talk to you later.
Bye.